So what comes to mind when you think about the word prepared or preparation? Exams? What else? Boy Scouts, be prepared. Yeah. Type A. Like the tone with that too. Type A. Lion King, Scar. Yeah. Was that like a song? Yeah, it was one of the songs. It's been a while. Anything else? Yeah, so the way we prepare for a test, what do? Put it off, cram. Yeah, that's how we some of us study. It just depends. A race. How do we prepare for a race if you're going to run a marathon or train? You don't just show up, you don't just wake up one morning and say, "Oh, the Austin Marathon's happening today. I think I'll run it. I haven't run in a while. That would be fun." So there's different types of preparation, right, for different things. Oftentimes preparation is a series of things we do to get ready for something. Yet how do we prepare to experience connection with someone? Like, how would you prepare for a date, per se? What do you think? Take a shower. Yeah, that's a good start. Maybe wear some nice clothes. Maybe think about something interesting to share, but not too much, you know, something like that. Well, our scripture today actually looks at a very different kind of preparation. Today we'll be looking at how we prepare for God. How do we prepare for the Creator of the universe, for the one who put the spark of life in us that animates us and the world we see? And in the liturgical calendar, we find ourselves in ordinary time. And our passage today is a story Jesus is telling about being ready to experience him in a moment and in the everyday. So we're going to be reading from Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13. So I'll invite you to read aloud together, as is our custom. So let's start off talking a little bit about the type of story Jesus is telling. This is actually a literary device known as a parable. And a parable was a familiar teaching device used by rabbis and teachers in Jesus' day. And they're kind of like a cone or a word puzzle that's meant to make us struggle. Like, it's meant to kind of make us curious that maybe there's something new. There's something we haven't, there's a thought in there that we haven't had before. So it invites us to kind of lean in. And only those who were open to something new could actually get into the parable, like it was something to enter into. In particular, Jesus uses parables frequently to talk about the paradox of God's kingdom, this idea that it's here, it's happening right now, but not yet. So it's this really interesting mystery. And we're going to take a look at there's a theologian I'm going to borrow from a little bit today to talk about this particular parable. But let's look a little bit at what this person says about Jesus's teaching on the kingdom of heaven. He says this: "There is no direct understanding of the kingdom. It is a strange thing, and people's minds are dulled, which is exactly what we would expect as a result of what we've seen about the human condition, our own included, shot through with death. It's worth our while to stop a little to see what this teaching in parables consists in. The parables are highly creative little stories sprung from Jesus' imagination and have as their aim helping people to overcome their being blocked up with respect to God and his project. However, behold, they are two-edged weapons capable of different interpretations. It is perfectly possible to interpret the greater part in terms of a violent God. In that case, the parables only serve to reinforce what people already think anyway, and they move no further." So just pause there for a minute, if you will. Is that what Jesus is doing? he's just, do we think he's just recapitulating what they already knew? He's just saying, yeah, this is what you already think. Is that why his teaching was recorded and handed down through time? Because he's just stating the obvious? Probably not, right? What, and this is what the author continues to say, what I'm suggesting is that this would be the dull-hearted reading of the parables. At the same time, it is perfectly possible to read the same parables as obliging us to overcome this vision. So kind of hang in there for this next part. It's kind of complex. This means that there is an interpretation for those who understand, and that what they understand will increase exponentially. And there is another interpretation for those who do not understand, so that what little they do understand is in the process of being lost. For they will get into an ever more tied up and painful understanding of the things of God. Sounds fun, right? Okay, so let's try to break this down a little bit. So Jesus often told stories that included what the people then assumed about God. Like they had an assumption that God is this certain way. And in those stories, he would insert the tiniest seed of difference. So most of it would be descriptive of what was already thought at that time. For those who guessed God might be different from what they were being told, then their understanding of God would flourish exponentially with Jesus' teaching. And for those who missed the point of who God was, who were rigidly holding on to the status quo, they would become lost, and what they thought they knew about God would become fuzzy. And they would become frustrated and tied up in the trappings of their thought. So here's another way to think about this. One of the things we do with the children here is we explain scripture through storytelling, through godly play. And when I was in Oregon, I actually learned how to present the godly play story. And so each of the stories, they come in this different form, and the parables were in these golden boxes. So when it was time to do a parable, you would go to the shelf, you would get this golden box, and you'd put it before the kids, and you would say, huh, I wonder what this is. I wonder what this could really be. You know, and the kids would kind of guess, I don't know, it looks like a box. It's gold. Yeah, maybe there's something valuable in it, because gold is the color of value in our culture. And then you would knock on the lid, and you would acknowledge, hey, it's closed. I wonder if there's something inside of it. And then sometimes what you would do is you would start to talk to them a little bit about how parables are gifts that were given to us long ago. But a lot of times they're closed to us, and that we have to be ready to go inside a parable. And then you would pause and you'd look around and you'd say, are you ready? In verse 1, it says, then the kingdom of heaven will be like this. 10 bridesmaids took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. When the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, all of them became drowsy and slept. But at midnight, there was a shout, look, here is the bridegroom. Come out to meet him. Then all those bridesmaids got up and trimmed their lamps. So the wise bring enough fuel. Jesus talks about the kingdom of heaven in a few different ways. He talks about it as an event, like when he dies, he's going to come back and he's going to bring the kingdom of heaven with him. So it's like a moment. A couple weeks ago, many of us went on a retreat and we had a moment. We had something different from our ordinary rhythm of life where we were able to worship more, have more conversation. We were able to interact with some new content. And sometimes I think when we go away, we feel like we need to replicate all of that in our ordinary life, if you will. Or we can feel like God's just in a moment on Sunday morning or just in a moment at a retreat. But Jesus also talks about the kingdom of heaven as every day, like when I wake up, when I pull myself out of bed, you know, when I have breakfast or coffee instead of breakfast, when I, you know, when I go to work, how do I interact? What do I notice? What don't I notice? That God is present in all of those little micro interactions as well. So God is interested in connecting with us in moments, but also in the ordinary fabric of life. For Jesus, any talk of the kingdom of God is about experiencing God as both an event and an ongoing possibility. And then the parable is about a wedding procession. The 10 bridesmaids were waiting to be collected by the bridegroom so they could conduct the bride from her father's house to the groom's house. So there's nothing really unique about this story so far. Like, this is a pretty common thing. If you were to get married, you'd be betrothed, likely, in that culture. Then you'd have the wedding, and then you would have this procession from your father's house to the groom's house. So that's what the bridesmaids are waiting for. And so the only thing that's unique about this story is that the bridegroom arrives a lot later than expected. And half of the bridesmaids are prepared, and the other half are not. And I think throughout history, folks try to make this passage say a lot of things. But actually, we're going to see that this parable is only highlighting one or two things, to be honest. It's only highlighting whether they brought enough fuel. I'm not saying God's pro oil. Fuel would have likely been olive oil at that time. But do they have enough resources? Do they have enough energy to see and follow the groom to collect his bride? So what makes five of them wise? They have enough energy for what matters. That's it, pretty much. The theologian James Allison says it this way: the wise maidens are those who had prepared themselves to sit out the duration. The patient, tranquil work that is furthermore non-transferable. So their work is work only they could do. They couldn't give it to other people. Of structuring a life in vigilant expectation because no one knows the hour. Thus, when the bridegroom comes, they are not taken by surprise, for the whole patient structure of their lives has been toward this. The whole patient structure of their lives. Sounds kind of idyllic, doesn't it? I'm not a very patient person a lot of times. So they're in for the long slog. I think most of us need a little bit more resilience built in to our spiritual journey. How do we structure our life in vigilant expectation, not knowing when we will touch into God? It could be this hour, or it could be the next. Have you ever run yourself ragged, getting ready for something important, only to show up so spent you were impervious to the experience even touching you? I was reflecting a little bit on my wedding day 17 years ago. And I remember very little of the day itself, actually. I mean, I remember Jenna, my wife, being very beautiful. Still is. I remember it being hot because we thought an outdoor wedding in May in Texas would be great. Mostly because it was cheap. It was free, the venue. I remember it being long because we had four friends who were musicians and we couldn't decide which one to ask to play a song, so we just asked them all. That was a mistake. They did great. They did great. It was just too long. That's all I'm saying. I remember keeping my knees slightly bent because someone told me if you keep your legs locked, you might faint. I don't know if that's actually true. I've never fact-checked that. But I was very conscious of that in the long heat in a dark suit. I remember telling my soon-to-be grandparents-in-law that we wouldn't be doing a unity candle, even as they unloaded it from their van, because we didn't know what it was. We didn't know. I remember getting angry with my cousins who used shoe polish on the paint of the car. And I thought, it's a beat up car, but I still remember we're about to drive away and it's just everywhere. So I remember washing the car because I was like, I don't want to find a car wash between here and the hotel. So as you can see, my experience of getting ready, of kind of doing everything ourselves, I think our wedding was like under $1,500. By the time the moment came, though, I wasn't really in a place to take it in. Like, I wasn't in a place to receive the moment and the meaning of it, the significance. I was more like the second group of bridesmaids in this passage, the foolish. The foolish don't bring enough fuel, as we see in verse 8. The foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise replied, "No, there will not be enough for you and for us. You had better go to the dealers and buy some for yourselves." And while they went to buy it, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went with him into the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Later, the other bridesmaids came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he replied, "Truly I tell you, I do not know you." So this parable doesn't say everything, right? So the bridegroom not knowing the bridesmaids and then being shut out, it does not tell us that God will shut us out of heaven. It does not tell us that God will punish us when we die if we're not ready. That's not what the parable's about. In fact, to the contrary, we know God knows each of us, and we will never have a moment we are not known completely, even in our darkest hour, that God doesn't even flinch. So that is not what the parable's about. And we're going to come back to this part in a minute. It doesn't say the foolish were irresponsible, that they were lazy or they didn't care. All it says is they forgot the most important thing. They forgot the extra fuel. They forgot the means to see in the dark and to follow the person of honor. Allison says the foolish ones had not considered how to live during the delay. They imagined a rapid arrival and because of this had not taken the precautions of prudence for the long vigil. They are not ready when the moment of grace arrives to engage it. Sometimes we're just not ready. Grace is all around us. It's in the moment, and we're just not in a place to receive it, to let it touch us. They may have been underprepared, or they may have been overprepared. In fact, both over and under preparation blind us to what's important. But the passage does say that the wise keep enough fuel for themselves first. Not more than they need, but enough. They're wise not because they bring... They're wise not only because they bring enough fuel, enough energy, but they're also wise because they don't overextend themselves for the other. That's really different for our culture, isn't it? I think a lot of us who are familiar with church culture have been taught to disregard our resources, to disregard how much fuel do I have? Can I really give this and have enough to light my path as well? I read this book right after college when I began to be able to choose books again, and it was called Boundaries. I just saw it on the bookshelf, and there was something in me that knew I need those. So I grabbed the book and the workbook that went with it. I was 22, and I remember one part of the book that just stopped me. It just shook me, and it said, "The most loving people are those who can say no." And it said, in fact, if you can't say no, then your yes is meaningless. I was like, ah, knife to the heart. Hear how radical this is. The expectation is that we each learn to carry enough fuel for the long night. We are expected to learn to carry our lives in a way that avails us to experience God. So we mentioned different types of preparation at the beginning today, right? So we're just going to look at a couple that might give us some handles on what the passage is talking about. So the first one we're going to call threat management preparation. I think we have a slide. Where we're always trying to be ready to avoid pain, rejection, and or judgment. Many of us say yes to everyone and everything to avoid the pain of loneliness, the pain of disappointing ourselves and others, the pain of being attacked, avoided, disapproved of, punished, etc. We can easily overprepare for threats to the exclusion of all else. So we all do this. Like, some amount of threat preparation is wise, right? But then there's a point in which we overdo it, I think, a lot of times. Consider for a moment how much of your preparation is rooted in avoiding threat. Like, if you had to put a percentage on it, you say, like, 20%? 19? 90, oh, okay. I was like, 19, all right. That's pretty good. We should have coffee this week. Tell me your secret. So some amount is helpful, but I'm guessing the amount for most of us is more than what's necessary, more than what's helpful. And there's another type of preparation I think this passage is alluding to. We'll call it enjoying God preparation. It's about having enough resources and sensitivity to our souls. Notice I didn't say God. I think sometimes when we can't connect with God, it's because we need to actually connect with ourselves first. We need to bring someone to the table to connect, if you will. And this is about having enough resources that when the moment of grace comes, now and now and now and now, we can simply receive it. We can let it in. So often I have the privilege of sitting with people, their early 20s to late 50s to late 70s sometimes, who are just learning that if we try to do it all, I'm still learning this, by the way. If we just try to do it all, though, and we don't make thoughtful choices, we can become impervious to God and to grace. I remember a very full season of life when we lived in Oregon. Had all these new things happening. I was trying to learn a new job. It was just a super stressful time. And in the midst of all of that new stuff, the thing I set aside was seeking God, like seeking a relationship. And I started to really get a level of fatigue like I hadn't known since like college, like that sense of going without sleep for days or something. I think I almost began to feel like an old pair of pants or a shirt that's like so thread-worn, like if you look at it, you could see your skin through it, you know? And it's not meant to be that, though. And I was like, okay, you know, something's got to shift. So I remember one day I just sat and I said, you know, I'm just going to sit in a chair and wait on God. And I had like a clock because I was like not going to do it that long. So I sat for a minute. Nothing. 2 minutes, nothing. 5 minutes, nothing. 10 minutes, nothing. 20 minutes, nothing. I mean, my mind's just got all these, but no God, no God in any of it. And then after a minute, I started to feel something. And that feeling kind of increased, and it started to overwhelm me. And it was actually a great sadness. I was like, wait a minute, I'm here to connect with God. You know, this is like supposed to be, I wanted it to be more positive or something in some way. And I became aware that I just really missed God, that I missed the sweetness of feeling God's presence. And I said to God, I said, God, I miss you. What's changed? Why are you so far away? And what I sensed in response was God saying, I'm right here, but you don't have the resources to enjoy our relationship right now. That was not what I wanted to hear. You don't have enough fuel. You don't have enough energy to actually be pervious, to be permeable to me. I knew how to prepare for many things, but I had no idea that enjoying God was something I needed to or even could prepare myself for. And I also learned it was okay to not enjoy my relationship with God all the time. It's okay to have periods where, you know, I need to push through. But it was unsustainable to choose this as a long-term pattern. I feel like I was saying, okay, it's okay this season. You're not enjoying it. That's okay. But as soon as you kind of get your feet under you with your job, it would be great if you kind of stored up some fuel again. if you kind of, you know, instead of recreating the same level of chaos, the same level of stress. So this week, I want to invite us, just as a practice, to invite God to teach us what preparing to experience Him would look like. Like, what would that be like now in my life if I were to try to save a little fuel to bring a flask of oil? What would that look like? This could be spiritual disciplines. I think for the last year, a lot of times the church is like, you just throw spiritual disciplines at everything, it'll solve everything. It won't, right? But it is still really important. So it may be time to re-up those. It could be a time just to pay attention to our rhythms. You know, we have a great rhythms of life thing that we use and we go through as a community. You know, paying attention to sleep, diet, exercise, friends. You know, yeah, look at that. Look at those things. It could also be sitting in a chair with a drink and reflecting on the day. At the end of the day, through the lens of grace. Say, where did I see grace today? Where did I feel alive? Where did I see darkness? Where did I sense life being drained out of me? So it's not one thing, but this is an invitation to be curious and to try a few things. Here's a couple questions that might be helpful. Where am I over-preparing for what is non-essential? So where is that, you know, when is that percentage of threat management? You know, maybe I'm hanging out in the 95th percentile and the higher number is not automatically it's not like getting 100. That's not the goal. Maybe it's more like golf if you want to get a low score. I think at times some of us are waiting to even take risks with God, like to put some weight on God a little bit, to trust because we don't feel ready. And we're preparing or managing the threat of failure so much that we may never feel ready. So sometimes now is like the best time to try that. And another question is, where am I underpreparing for what is essential? Where am I underpreparing to enjoy God? So perhaps our work is just to pause a little bit more. Talked to a guy a week ago, and he was away on a sabbatical, came back, got flooded with work, flooded with relationship stuff, different things. And he said, it's really crazy. He said, it's really good. I said, really, what's making it good? He says, every now and then I just pause. Like I just slow down and stop. And I feel this sense of God's goodness with me. It's like awesome. So maybe it's just finding the pause button every now and then. So why does preparing to connect with God and enjoy God even matter? Like, why should, you know, I like to ask, and I've heard Gideon say this, likes to ask the question, why should anybody care about this stuff? Because preparation to experience God can guide all of our other types of preparation. In verse 13, Jesus says, keep awake, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. The way we prepare for Jesus coming, for our last days, and for God's ongoing availability for intimacy, it affects every other type of preparation in our life. The closest thing I can find to describing this type of staying awake is what Richard Louv calls hyper-awareness. He's an author who's done advocacy for children and adults having time in nature. And he says this in an interview when he talks about the difference between hypervigilance and hyper-awareness. Usually hypervigilance, behavior manifested by always being on guard and ready to fight or flee, is associated with trauma in childhood. Not always, though. You don't have to have trauma to be hypervigilant, actually. So I'm adding that. He didn't say that. But the hyper-awareness gained from experience in nature may be the flip side of hypervigilance, a positive way to pay attention and, when it's appropriate, to be on guard. Sometimes we need to, just not all the time. We're familiar with the term street smart. Perhaps another wider adaptive intelligence is available to the young. Call it nature smart. One father I spoke to said he believes that a child in nature is required to make decisions not often encountered in a more constricted, planned environment. Ones that not only present danger, but opportunity. Organized sports, with its finite set of rules, is said to build character. If that is true, and of course it can be, nature experience must do the same in ways we do not fully understand. A natural environment is far more complex than any playing field. Nature does offer rules and risk and subtly informs all the senses. So Louv talks, and I don't know if I'm saying his name right, so apologies to you, Mr. Richard. He talks a lot about ADHD as kind of a low grade, or potentially, he talks about this a possibility, as it being a low grade form of hypervigilance, or what we're calling threat management. It's kind of a sustained low grade anxiety that we are always trying to be ready and perceive most things as threat. So you can't focus too much on one thing because you have to be ready. You have to welcome the interruption, if you will, because it could, there's an assumption it's probably going to be something negative or threat. Hyper-awareness gives us an ability to assess threats more accurately and respond when necessary, but also allows us to experience life as more than just a threat. Keeping awake, it makes us pervious. It makes us permeable to grace. Really starting to pay attention and practice awareness is actually a great foil to some types of anxiety. Okay, so let me just say this. We're kind of, as we're wrapping up, whatever you do with this passage, or better still, allow this passage to do with you, I invite you to pay attention to what about it that's waking you up. What's important? Because I think sometimes our spiritual practices become another form of hypervigilance. Like we begin to see God as a threat from whom I must protect myself through being pure enough, right enough, spiritual enough, disciplined enough. Like we have to do those things in order for God to be pleased with us. And this is often based on a vision actually of a violent God, whether we're conscious of that or not. And into this vision, Jesus speaks a parable, a tiny, harmless story for the person who's ready for something new. And for that person, it can change everything. He says, keep awake. Allison says, regarding the parables, it seems to me that Jesus' technique is much more interesting. Jesus is taking for granted a certain understanding of God and seeking to introduce a hidden shock into it. He knows very well that were he to speak directly about God, people would answer him back, quoting contrary proof texts, and they would go round and round in circles indefinitely. Because of this, he is prepared to work in hostile territory, using the imaginative world of his hearers, but putting into it a little time bomb, which, when it explodes, can cause a change in that imaginative world. So what is the hidden shock for you that will go off later today or this week and change your imaginative world? You don't know that yet, right? Because it's hidden. So what if the groom saying he never knew them was about the bridesmaid's disappointment of not getting to connect with someone, some experience that they're longing to see, they're drawn to? What if you could pick someone alive today, like anyone on the planet, or maybe a show, any show on the planet, that you could spend time, let's think about the person actually instead of the experience. Like, who would it be? Like, who would you want to, you don't have to say, but it took me a while to think about it this morning. And then I kind of bailed and thought of someone who had actually already passed away. Would have loved to take a walk with Henry Nouwen, who's a spiritual writer, but so I cheated my own question. But so you know you're going to get to hang out with this person tonight, okay? And they say, hey, don't forget a flashlight. And by the way, bring some extra batteries because it's a long walk. And we may walk all through the night. And I walk kind of fast, actually. Would you just bring a flashlight? Or would you bring batteries also? Imagine a people for whom so many teachers had made God seem repulsive. Imagine a people who are taught God is very scary and wants your behavior, but he could take or leave you. The groom was someone they would chase after in the night. they would be made extremely vulnerable. But they didn't care. All that mattered was being able to see where he was going so they could be with him and celebrate. Can you imagine the response to being given this favorable picture? I can imagine the response of those people hearing Jesus, and then later that day when the little time bomb went off, pew, I can imagine the conversation being something like this. Wait. You mean God is someone we would even want to experience? Like, you mean it's someone we would even want to get ready for? Wait a minute, because our BS meter is going crazy right now. That is so different. Because do you know what that means? That means that all the words and all the ideas about God that make me want to throw up, that send me running away, they might not be real. The moment of grace is before us. Stay awake. Is our preparation about avoiding threat, or is it about experiencing a desirable God? I'll leave you with a poem that serves as an invite today as well as a blessing as we close. It's entitled Camas Lilies. Consider the lilies of the field, the blue banks of camas opening into acres of sky along the road. Would the longing to lie down and be washed by that beauty abate if you knew their usefulness? How the natives ground their bulbs for flower, how the settlers' hogs uprooted them, grunting in gleeful oblivion as the flowers fell. And you, what of your rushed and useful life? Imagine setting it all down. Papers, plans, appointments, email, Facebook, everything. Leaving only a note. Gone to the fields to be lovely. Be back when I'm through with blooming. Even now, unneeded and uneaten, the camas lilies gaze out above the grass from their tender blue eyes. Even in sleep, your life will shine. Make no mistake, of course, your work will always matter. Yet Solomon, in all his glory, was not arrayed like one of these. Pray with me. God, shave the dullness and deadness from our hearts and eyes. We long to see you for who you are. Help us wake up. We're so weary from playing at darkness. We long to be alive and whole in you. In the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit.